Parashat Vayakhel begins, Vayakhel Moshe et kol adam b'nei Yisrael, Vayomer lehem eila dvarim asher tzivah Hashem lasot otam. The people will gather together, the entire community of Israel gathered together, and Moshe said, these are the things that God commanded to do. Now, Sefer Shemot does create some difficulties, especially concerning chronology. And the truth is, we, at least according to those opinions that say that it doesn't follow the proper chronology, what we need to do when we study is to look at things with probably with two different eyes. On the one hand, we need to pay attention to what should be the proper chronology of events. And the second thing we should be paying attention to is the narrative and the way that it's told. Because obviously, if this is the way it's written, then God believes that there is a certain value in telling the story this way, even though the events might not have happened this way. Just for example, just to get you thinking a little bit, according to what we can figure out, where were we up to yesterday? Not yesterday. At the end of last week, where were we up to? At the end of Parshat Ki Tisa. Where is we? At what juncture are we at that point? Right. So, what's the date that last week's parsha ends? The date. What day is it? The day after Yom Kippur is when it should. So therefore, Vayakhel should begin right after Yom Kippur. Moshe comes down. Moshe comes down on Yom Kippur. The people are forgiven. And in fact, Rashi, sure hope Rashi says this. Yes. Good. Rashi says, Vayakel Moshe, Moshe gathered the people, L'mochrat Yom HaKippurim, Kishirah B'Nahar. So again, Rashi's focusing us on the chronology. When does this take place? It took place when Moshe, the day after Yom Kippur, when Moshe came down from the mountain. So as I said, just to get you thinking a little bit, if we were to look in Parshat Yitro, this is all the way back in Perek Yudched. Here we're told that Yitro arrives and they have a whole celebration. And then in Pasuk Yud Gimel of Perek Yudched, it writes, Vayihimi Macharat. And then it happened on the next day. What happened on the next day? Vayeshev Moshe l'shpot et ha'am. Moshe sits to judge the people. Now, based on what is Moshe judging the people at that point? What laws exist at that point? What? Okay, so if it's the Torah, then we have a slight problem, and that is the Torah had not been given as of chapter 18. The Torah is not given until chapter 20. And the Mishpatim had not learned until chapter 22, 21, 22, 23. So what is this Mimacharat? So Rashi, who's obviously aware of this problem, and by the way, you could have said that if backed by Mara, Rashi himself says that God gave the people some laws, Miksat HaTorah, gave them some laws, it could be the people started to follow him. Nonetheless, Rashi doesn't go and base himself on Mara. Rather, Rashi in Pasuk Gimel writes, "Vayihimi Macharat Motzei Yom Kippurim Haya." It's after Yom Kippur. Now, by the way, here it says Motzei Yom Kippur, the night after Yom Kippur, and we start Vayakhel. It says Mimacharat. This is the next day. Even though over here it says Mimacharat, so Macharat should also have been the next day. So I'm not sure Rashi writes it this way, but either way, from chapter 18 to chapter 35, we're at the same point. Okay, so just in case you're drawing the timeline, we're at the same point, and therefore a lot of things that happen in the middle don't necessarily happen in their proper sequence. But again, the narrative is told in a particular way. As I said, just going to Rashi to see the issues involved. And again, we all know that the major trauma which took place and the major impetus for telling the story in a different way, at least according to Rashi, is the sin of the golden calf, the Chet HaEgel, which is told in the middle of the story of the building of the Mishkan, even though it's, again, according to Rashi, it was only commanded afterwards. Now, back to source number one, beginning of our parasha. Moshe gathers the people when? After Yom Kippur. Now, Moshe has not had a real opportunity of giving public speeches for a while. So if you think about it, they get to Mount Sinai. Moshe prepares them to receive the Torah. Moshe goes up the mountain. We have the revelation at Sinai. Then Moshe goes all the way up the mountain to get the Luchot. And that takes him 40 days, give or take, which of course that give or take creates a huge problem, because they thought it was give and it ended up being take. And ultimately, Moshe comes down and the people are worshipping the golden calf, and then Moshe, you know, has to do his cleanup mission, and then goes up and prays again, and then Moshe goes up, perhaps according to Rashi, a third time, and he gets a second Luchot, it's Yom Kippur, and Moshe comes down, which means Moshe received 40 days worth of revelation that first time he went up, and had apparently no opportunity to share that with the people. Which therefore means, and again, it's quite likely that a lot of the narrative, if not all of it, from Parshat Mishpatim is what Moshe learned when he was up in the mountain. And that's why it follows the Seret HaDibrot. It's possible, if not likely, that a lot of the material in Perek Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, and Kaf Gimel, which is most of the laws of Parshat Mishpatim, is what Moshe learns when he's up on the mountain. Okay? Either way, Moshe should have learned a huge amount of material while he was there. Right? Mm-hmm. What exactly he learned is probably a very interesting topic, yes?
And Moshe came down the first time, Yom Kippur?
No, the first time was Shivasa B'Tamuz. So now Moshe has a whole bunch of things that he could use as his starting point in his lecture, or the topic, the first thing he would teach. Theoretically, he could have expanded upon any of the Seret HaDibrot. Theoretically, if he learns according to what we say in Pirkei Avot, he could have taught any of the 613 mitzvot, Moshe Kibbel Torah Misinai. Moshe could have taught any of that. Matter of fact, Moshe apparently would have learned Torah the first time, would have learned something the second time. There's just so much information that he should have at this point that he could teach. Where does he begin? And let's read the verse carefully now. Vayikal Moshe et kol adat b'nei Israel, and Moshe gathers the entire community of Israel, vayomer lehem, and he said to them, Eila hadivarim, these are the things, asher tziva Hashem lasot otam, which God commanded to do. And where does he begin? Sheshet yamim ta'aseh melacha, uviyom hashvi'iyeh lachem kodesh. What's the commandment? No, 6 days you should work. Right? You mean, I think a lot of people miss that part. 6 days you should work, and the seventh day should be holy. Sheshet yamim ta'aseh melacha, uviyom hashviyeh lachem kodesh, Shabbat Shabbaton Lashem, kol ha'oseh bo melacha yumat. Whoever does work will be put to death, and then lo tivor esh b'chol moshvateichem yom haShabbat, and then fire is dealt with specifically, which is quite strange because most laws of Shabbat are not dealt with specifically. Shabbat is. And so, sorry, fire is. Why would Moshe choose this to be the first thing to teach?
This is the last thing Hashem told him before he gave him the first
one. So ostensibly, this is the last thing that was taught before. Look at source Lamed Aleph. Sorry, source 2, Perek Lamed Aleph. The last thing that Moshe learns when he's up on the mountain, Vayomar Shem El Moshe Lemor, Vata Daver B'nei Yisrael, Lemor Achet Shav Totai Tishmor, Ki Oti B'ni U'Veinechem, L'dor Teichem, L'dat Ki Ani Hashem Mekadishchem. You should command them about the Shabbat, for it's a sign between me and the Jewish people. Ki Ani Hashem Mekadishchem, and I'm God who has sanctified it, them. Ushmartim et Shabbat Ki Kodesh Yilachem, Mechalem Mot Yumat, Kol HaSabo Melacha V'Nichvatai Nefeshim Himi Kerev Ameah. Whoever does work will be taken after the people. Sheshet yamim ya'aseh melacha. 6 days do work. Yom shvi'i, Shabbat Shabbaton, Kodesh LaHashem. The seventh day is the Sabbath. It's holy for God. Kol asa melacha bo b'yom Shabbat mo yumat. And whoever does work will be put to death. V'shamru b'nei Yisrael to Shabbat, lasot et Shabbat ladoratam brit olam. The Jewish people should keep the Shabbat. It should be a covenant forever. B'ni uvem b'nei Yisrael, between me and the Jewish people, oti li'olam, it's a sign forever, ki sheshet yimim asa Hashem et ha'shamayim et ha'aretz, yivyom ishi Shabbat yinafash. For 6 days God created, and the seventh day God rested. Which means that something which is all, it's for us, it's very simple. We knew this, you need to come here today to know that Shabbat commemorates creation. And then right after that verse, v'yitain el Moshe, ki chalato l'daberito, and when God completed speaking to him, Bahar Sinai on Mount Sinai, Shnei Luchot Avadim, Luchot Eidut, he gave him two tablets of stone, Ketuvim Be'etzba Elokim, written with the hand of God or finger of God. So therefore, the last thing that God taught Moshe is the first thing that Moshe teaches. Now, how does that answer the question? It's correct. But the question is, what is, meaning, again.
In other words, Hashem told them about Shabbos, gives them the
hook,
then the
eagle. So let's just say Moshe came down the mountain right then at that point. Let's just think this through for a second. See, your answer is definitely the right answer. The only question is if it's the right answer to the question. Again, this could be my fault. No, it could be my fault. Maybe I asked the wrong question. But you're right that it's the last thing that God taught Moshe before he came down. And apparently I noticed that as well. That's why we put it there.
Okay,
But let's say there wouldn't have been a Chet Egel, and Moshe comes down. So why would you assume that Moshe is going to start teaching with the last thing that God said? Again, the same question comes back. As an educator, Moshe could have chosen any of the commandments that are there. He could have started with the last one. He could have started the first one. He could have started the middle one. It could have been raining. It stops raining. A rainbow comes out, and Moshe says, "Let me teach you the bracha you make on a rainbow." I'm saying there could have been many, many things that Moshe could have chosen. The observation that this is the last thing that God taught him is a correct observation. Why was it the first thing then that Moshe chose to speak? Now, obviously, I agree with you that it is interesting that the way that the Torah ends up being written has the last thing God teaches and the first thing Moshe teaches is the same thing. So it seems to us that there's some significance to it. We just don't, I think, as of yet, know what that significance is. You can shoot anyone you want.
Isn't Judaism based on Shabbat? Mirat Shabbat?
And had it... See, we're playing Monday morning quarterback. Had it been right over here, the first thing that Moshe teaches, and God says, and not to make idols, so what would you all be saying? Well, Judaism is based on rejection of idolatry, so therefore he taught them this. And then you would have said, and then you would have continued to say, oh, look, because of the Chet HaEgel, that's why he taught them this. Which means, if it would have been something else, then you'd be saying, oh, but isn't Judaism based on this? Yes, one of the most important things about Judaism is keeping Shabbat. But despite that, I just don't know if the answer is convincing. Yes. She defers.
It's one of the first things that we learn in the Torah and Bereshit about Hashem creating the world.
Absolutely correct.
It's not the answer.
I don't know the answer.
I connected what you said, because the problem was that they lost the connection to God. That's why they did the Egel.
Correct. So let's think this through a little bit more. If this is the last thing that God is teaching Moshe, what are the people doing down below at the same time that Moshe is having this lesson? The people are either making...
Planning, making, or...
Look, I don't know what the travel time is between up in heaven to come down to Mount Sinai. It's probably shorter than the flight that I took this week. But if it's the last thing that God teaches, the people are at least involved in the Egel at this point. And therefore, if you would have this, you know, wonderful split-screen television showing Moshe above and the people below, you would really have a stark difference. But God is speaking about Shabbos and the people are making the Egel. And maybe what goes through Moshe's mind is that the spirituality which they're seeking in alien gods could have been solved by people having a more profound connection to Shabbos. Again, I'm not telling you that this is the answer. I'm just saying is that if Moshe, and Moshe certainly would realize that the people are doing this sin as God is teaching them this thing, maybe he's then teaching that God is telling them this thing at this point because that's what the people needed to hear at this particular point.
But the people wanted something visual to see, and Shabbos is not visual.
Cholent is visual. You can see it, you can feel it. It stays with you. There's a book that I have at home on Chinuch, and it's written by a Satmar Chassid, and he goes through all kinds of mitzvot from the Torah, Midrabanan, and he goes to at which point should you do Chinuch or teach your kid to that particular mitzvah, And then he gets to the mitzvah of eating cholent on Shabbos. And he says that the Satmar Rebbe told him that this is one of the things that you have to educate. You be mechanef your kids from the youngest possible age. And he writes, because ikari emuna, the very essence of faith are in cholent. And he doesn't, explain how the essence of faith is. So I was thinking, I had three different explanations for it. I should really write him. One explanation would be is that, again, on a very simple level, that cholent, if you think about the Karaites, for example, who say that you're not allowed to light something, because of this passage, they understood you couldn't have a fire even going, and you have to sit in the dark. Chazal tell, it doesn't mean that you can't have a fire going, you can't start a fire, cause a fire to burn, and therefore Jews will eat hot food on Shabbos in order to show that we believe in what Chazal are telling us. So therefore, the very eating of cholent is believing in Chazal. And by the way, this year, when all of you celebrate Purim, right, you will be believing in Chazal at that moment, because if there were not two others, it's Pesach. Right? So as you're eating your hamantash, realize that that is an act of believing in Chazal, right? Because otherwise you should be...
Purim itself.
But I'm saying, this year with the two others... Well, there's two Adars, which is you don't believe in Adar Bet, that's Pesach. So therefore, eating your Hamantashen is a manifestation of belief in Chazal. Okay, so that was one interpretation. The second would be that cholent is an act of faith, because you put the whole thing up before Shabbos, and then you can't do anything to it. Yeah. Right? You, in terms of the cooking aspect of it, you just put it there, and then, you know, you rely... And therefore, a cholent would be a direct correlation of the person who makes it, of the Yirat Shemayim, and more Yirat Shemayim, the cholent will be better, less than the cholent won't work. But then occurred... What?
Cholent is always good, no matter what.
Not on Tuesday. So then it occurred to me a third explanation, that it could be that eating cholent and then lying down and taking a rest afterwards is belief in Tchiyat HaMeitim. It's belief that, you know, that God will bring us all back to life afterwards, and therefore it's one of the... So I don't know which the Satmar Rebbe had in mind, but obviously he's a very smart man, so he probably thought of all three of them. Okay. So now you have something to say on Shabbos. Okay, so now we can continue. So, what we then have is the Chet HaEgel is sandwiched between two statements of Shabbos. Which means, again, if I go back to thinking about the events, how they took place in the proper chronology, we have the last thing that God says to Moshe before the Chet HaEgel is about Shabbos. The first thing that Moshe teaches the people after the whole thing is over is about Shabbos. So I now have the story with almost two brackets, which are Shabbos, and that's something which we need to think about. Again, all the interpretations that you said may be true, and they are true. The question, though, is what then is the significance of this? Okay, let's go a little bit further. There's another element in this week's parasha, and what I'm about to say is really not fair. And I'll tell you why it's not fair, because I could have chosen any one of the elements of this week's parasha, because the parasha is very repetitive. Not that it repeats itself, but it repeats things we've already seen. While Truma and Tetzaveh give us instructions, do this, do this, and do this, now, in this week's parasha, in Vayakel and Pekudei, we have the people did it. So therefore, the things that are mentioned there will be mentioned here. And I want to focus on one particular thing, and even though, as I said, you could claim it's not fair, when I think about the entire concept of the Mishkan, it seems that the purpose of the Mishkan is to provide a place for the Luchot to reside. That's the purpose of it. And therefore, the idea of God speaking to the people at Mount Sinai on a one-time, as the Ramban tells us, as a one-time experience, now God will speak from where the Aron is, through the top of the Aron, through the top of the Ark, where the Kruvim are standing. And that's something which was spelled out very clearly in Parshat Truma. what it says in this week's parasha, source 3, Vaya'as shnei kruvim, they made the two kruvim, Zahav mikshe asa utam mishnei ktzot hakporet. They made it out of, it was done, that means now it was implemented. Kruvachad mikatzeh mizeh, kruvachad mikatzeh mizeh, the two kruvim were made on the two sides, min hakaporet asa et kruvim mishnei ktzotav. V'yu kruvim porsei knafayim, they spread out their wings, lamala, sochachim mikapayim ala kaporet, and they touched, the wings touched on top of the covering of the aron. Upnehem ish el achiv el hakaporet hayu pnei hakruvim, and they faced ish el achiv. Now, almost an exact description is in source number 4 when we were told about it in Truma, which again is unsurprising and unremarkable. Here it says va'asita. This is what you should do. Shnei kruvim zahav and so on. Which means here's the instruction, here's the implementation. And here I'm going to give you, and it's interesting, how does it describe the luchot here? The edut, the testimony. And here is, from here I will communicate with you. And the sound of God will emanate from on top of the kaporet between the two kruvim, asher al aron edut et kol asher atzavotcha el bnei Yisrael. Anything which the people need to hear, from this place, the sound of God will emanate, will come out. In both places, it uses the phrase ish el achiv, and you see that I bolded that. And you know what? At face value, ish el achiv sounds like a very nice thing. Right? Ish el achiv, man, to his brother. The only problem is, if you take a very quick look at every time in Chumash that the words or the phrase Ish El Achiv is used, it seems to be almost every single time to have a negative connotation, with perhaps one exception, which we'll see also has something negative. If you want to look from the first verse, verse 5, Vayomer Ish El Achiv, Hinei Bal HaChalomot Ba, so Halazeh, Bal HaChalomot Halazeh Ba, regarding the sale of Yosef. Ish el achiv, one says to the other, Rashi Shimon to Levi. Later on, again in the story of Yosef, Vayomer Ish el achiv, aval ashamim anachnu, alachenu asher inu tzarat nafsho b'itchananu aleinu, velo shamanu al kein ba'aleinu hatzara hazot. So the first time is when they're plotting to sell Yosef, the second time is when they realize all these terrible things happened because of the sale of Yosef. Later on, when the money is put back into their bags, again the story of Yosef, it says, "Vayomer el achiv hushav kaspi v'gam hinei pa'am tachti v'yetzei libam v'yerchdu ish el achiv le'mor mazot asa elokim lanu." So again, but by the way, these are the only times the phrase is used in Bereshit. Have I convinced you that it's not necessarily a happy phrase? In Shemot, it's used, aside from the Kruvim, one time. Source 8, V'yir'u b'nei Yisrael, V'yomru ish el achiv man hu, regarding when they see the man. So let's skip that one for a second. Source 9, V'bamidbar. Again, the people are one of the endless numbers of complaints. Source 9, in Bamidbar, it says, V'yomru ish el achiv na'rosh v'nashuv v'mitzrayma. Let's go back home, let's go back to Egypt. So as I said, every single time the phrase Ish El Achiv is used in the Torah, with the possible exception of the man, has a negative side to it. Regarding even this use, let's look at source number 10. Source number 10 is written by somebody known as the Mabit. The Mabit lived at the same time as the Arizal, he lived in Tzfat. If anybody studied the laws of Shemitah, you would know that the Mabit did not agree with the Yosef Karo regarding certain aspects of Shemitah. He also wrote a wonderful book on Jewish philosophy, which is called Beit Elokim, which is a book which is not all that difficult and has a lot of really basic teachings of Judaism all in one book, written by somebody who was really quite significant. In this chapter, he deals with a very simple question. We know that in the Midbar, there were three miracles that took place. What were the three miracles?
The man.
The man.
Water.
The be'er. And the ananei hakavod. The man was connected to Moshe. The ananei hakavod are connected to Aaron. And the be'er is connected to Miriam. Right? One of those three has a holiday which is connected to it. And that's the Adonai HaKavod, which is Sukkot. So over here, he really asks a very simple question. Why don't we also have a holiday that celebrates the Be'er, or a holiday that celebrates the Mun? Right? The answer that the Mabit gives, and we'll read it inside in a second, is that Mun and water are necessities, while the Ananei HaKavod is a luxury. And therefore, based upon man's natural needs, man needs bread and water, which of course you can argue that Mun is not real bread. There's actually a very serious halachic question: what bracha do you make on Mun? You can't say Hamotzi Lechem in Haaretz. So do you say Hamotzi Lechem in Hashamayim, or do you say Berei Minei Mizonot? Well, again, I'm saying there is a serious question about what bracha you would make on Mun. If you ever get some, then call up. You can say Pesach is bread also. I mean,
right, okay.
But I'm just saying is you have to work a lot harder rather than stated. And again, his approach is that no, only something which is more supernatural and something which is a luxury, or the way that he phrases it, something which is based on midat harachamim, on God's compassion, rather than on a necessity, because without the man, without the be'er, the Jews would have died. You would not have survived. Without the Ananei HaKavod, then their quality of life may have been different, but that's already considered luxury, and that's what we're celebrating. Let's read what he writes. The Efshar Loma Kigam Sheba'er V'aman Hayu Nisim Mefor Samim La'in Kol, even though these were miracles, clear, open miracles that everyone can see, V'hitmidu Kol Arbim Shana, and we had them for 40 years, Kevin Shehaya Davar Hechrechi She'if Sharbli Mitziotam, because they were necessary, they were essential, and without their existence, it would be impossible to live. Therefore, we don't need them to be commemorated. I'm skipping down a little bit. And let me translate the last part of this. He says that the truth is, all year long, whenever you eat bread or whenever you drink water or wine or something, you can say, this is because of the... But he says you can think that, but that's not really what's going on. But he said, pay attention. Aaron's behavior was what we call lefnim mishur hadin. Aaron went beyond the letter of the law. Aaron went and tried to create peace, and therefore Aaron's whole essence is one of rachamim, and he tries to create peace among people, so therefore God's response to Aaron was to give bischut Aaron something which was also lefnim mishur hadin, which therefore represents rachamim, represents God's compassion. And therefore these things were necessary, so therefore Moshe and Miriam represent a necessity, while Aaron represents something which goes beyond the letter of the law. And then he says a very interesting thing as he continues, V'hi ha-Torah shenim shalah lahem. And Torah is compared to water or bread at times. And he says, therefore, Shemosh Rabbeinu haya melamed Torah la'anashim, u'Miriam l'nashim. V'mashim chayavet, v'nirmas ba'elu ha-shnei nisim ha-havayim ayadam, And just as an added in, he tells us that the truth is that the water and the bread represented by the Be'er and the Mun, represented by Miriam and Moshe, actually have another representation, and that is Torah. Because just as a Jew can't live without water and bread, so too a Jew can't live without Torah. Which, by the way, sets up for us a very interesting association. Is Torah essentially something which we would call midat hadin, or is Torah essentially something which we would call midat harachamim? Which means, If I had to make a distinction between these three miracles, one of them was lefnim mishurat hadin, beyond din. What do you call this thing which is beyond din? That's rachamim. And that's what Aaron is about. On the other hand, Moshe, right? Moshe, the lawgiver. Moshe is a man of law. Moshe is somebody who gives us Torah. So is Torah based upon din, law? And by the way, that sounds like a very simple connection, Torah and law. Or is Torah based upon rachamim? Yeah.
Torah is also called Emet, and you often taught us that Emet is in the of Yaakov, that is the
combination
of Rachman and Indy.
Okay. So I won't argue. If you say that's what I said, maybe I should argue. So first of all, let's notice something. When God speaks at Har Sinai, in source number 11, the revelation begins, Vayidaber Elokim et kol hadrim ha'el lemar. Elokim said, what does the name Elokim imply?
Din.
Rashi writes in source 13, Vayidaber Elokim, ein Elokim ela dayan. The name, there, if you're ever looking for where Rashi says it, it's right there. But what's the context? It's giving the Torah. So therefore, where does the Torah emanate from? Vayidaber Elokim et kol hadrim ha'el. Now, obviously, this is not as simple as I'm putting it, because the very next line says, Anochi Hashem, back in source 11, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. So, you know, if it's Vayidaber Elokim, Anochi Hashem, so what is it? The reality is that God is Hashem, right? Yud Kei Vav Kei. On the other hand, the sound that comes out is coming out from Elokim. This is something which is not so simple. I also want to point out that the roughly 250 to 300 times in the Gemara, if you need a precise number, I can get it for you, but approximately, someplace in between, I would say closer to 300, the Gemara, when quoting a pasuk, when quoting what it says in the Torah, refers to the Torah as Amar Rachmana or Rachmana Amar. Look at source number 12, just for one such case, regarding blowing the shofar. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Lama Tokin B'Rosh Hashanah. Why do we blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah? Lama Tokin, why do we blow the shofar? Rachmana Amar Tek'u, because the Torah says blow. Ah, Ela Lama Mar'in, why do we blow a tru'ah? So it says Mirin, Rachmana Amar Zichron Truah, because the Torah says. So therefore, as I said, hundreds of times, the Torah, the Gemara refers to the Torah as Rachmana. What does the word Rachmana mean? Rachamim.
How many times does the Gemara refer to the Torah as
King? I don't know. I don't know, but we do speak of the Aseret Dibrot being Mipi HaGvura. And Gvura is Din. Mipi HaGvura. So on the one hand, the revelation is considered to be Mipi HaGvura, coming from the mouth of Midat HaDin, Ezo Gibor HaKavoyet Shetz Yitzro, the name Elokim is connected with Gvura, with Midat HaDin. And on the other hand, we refer to Torah as Rachamim. So again, this does not have to be an either-or, either this is correct or that is correct. Let's look at what Rabbeinu Bachai says in Source 14. Va'al Devar HaKabbalah, based upon tradition, Va'idaber Elokim, when it says Vayidaber Elokim in our verse by Revelation, Ze Pirusho, what does it really mean? Vayidaber Hashem. Aval Hiskir Elokim Klape Hasagatan Shel Yisrael. That the perception of the people was that it was din. They heard din while God was speaking out of Rachamim. One second. A parent tells a child, I want you home at 12 o'clock, right? What does the child hear? My parent is really strict in telling me what to do. What is the parent expressing? Rachamim, their love and concern for the kid. Which means that there's a difference between motivation for law versus perception of the people. So Rabbeinu Bachai says this very clearly. Vayidaber Elokim, it's not what it was. It was really Hashem. But this is the perception of the people. They perceived the law to be emanating from Din. But what's the reality? The reality is Rachamim. But when you're standing there at the place and your parents are telling you what to do, so then how does it come out?
Especially there's lightning and thunder.
Especially there's lightning and thunder. So what we now realize is things are more complex than we perhaps had understood. If we'll skip a little bit, turn to page 3. He'll make the same point numerous times within this section. Where it's underlined on the top of the next page. Ki Hashem yuchad hu amidaber hayaraui hakatuv lomar v'idaber Hashem et kol d'mo'ele. It could have been, or it should have been, that it was written, and Hashem said, but then he tells us, in the next place where it's underlined, ki lashon ha'ivri holeich achar hasagat Yisrael, ki lashon ha'ivri holeich achar hasagat Yisrael, ulekach hizkir debelokim, v'tirgum unkulus achar achar hasagat Moshe, ulekach tirgim v'deber elokim, umalil Hashem. So I skipped a lot of his proofs over here, but I'm just going to say it very quickly. You can go back and look this up. He says, if you look in the whole Chumash, how Unkelos translates Elohim generally versus how Unkelos translates Elohim in this section. In this section, he translates it differently. He translates Elohim as Hashem, which means, according to Rabbeinu Bachaye, that it goes back to this idea of perception. That the people perceived one thing, Moshe perceived something else, and God's intention was obviously closer to what Moshe perceives. But by the way, this concept of multiple perceptions at Sinai is a fascinating concept which could be explained and could explain many other things. Just off the top of my head, the Rambam says clearly in the Mor Nevuchim that each person on the mountain, standing in a different place, had a different vantage point and understood what was taking place differently. The Rakhanati, one of the mystical commentaries, tells us, and that's why, that explains this idea of Eilu Eilu Divru L'Kim Chayim, because each person has a legitimate different perception of what God said. Because, you know, if you're looking at a picture, and where you're standing could allow you to see the picture somewhat differently, and your perception is a true perception, and therefore, the Rakhanati explains the whole idea of a multiplicity of doctrine of why you can have Eilav Eilav Divrim Chaim, you can have different opinions, and both opinions are legitimate, because both opinions represent a true perception of what God said. So as I said, there's a lot more to be said about this, but over here, the people understand something different from what God is communicating. Moshe understands that which God is saying, and it's really emanating from Rachamim. So therefore, Unkelos explains what God said as Moshe understands, because that's the most legitimate interpretation. He goes on a little bit, and we're skipping now to towards the end of that big paragraph, where he writes, V'zesod, towards the end of the line, V'zesod ma sha'amru rezal, zocho v'shamor b'dibur echad nemru. And this is the secret behind the zocho and the shamor being said at once, ki zochor midat rachamim v'shomor midat hadin. To remember the Sabbath day, to sanctify it, is based upon rachamim. To guard the Sabbath day is based upon din. V'hu akol b'zochor v'shomor midat rachamim midat hadin. U'mitam zeh hayu haluchot shtayim, chamesh keneged chamesh, luach achad keneged midat rachamim, v'luach sheni sheyesh bo hei dibrot gamkin, Behei lavin umatchil lo tirtzach kineged midat hadin. Lakein hayu shnayim v'lo yakol v'lo chachad. And he says that the reality is that both of these perceptions are true, and therefore it's a zocha v'shamor b'dibur echad, midat haracham and midat hadin coexist, and that's why he's saying ultimately why we have two luchot. Let's get to the last paragraph. V'yesh lecha ledat ki hu ha'elokim hanikra shem, V'hu yoshev ha-kruvim. And now, if you haven't noticed, we've gotten back to the kruvim. Have I lost you, by the way, along the way today, or no?
No.
You still okay? That this is the name by the kruvim. Remember, the kruvim had isha lachiv. Remember, every isha lachiv was negative. The only isha lachiv that may not have been negative or din would have been the one by the man, but now we've learned that the man as well is an aspect of din and is not rachamim. The rachamim was the clouds. And now we've moved to see that the Torah itself is understood as din, but we realize that things are a lot more complicated because there's reality, there's perception, there's multiple perceptions, but there's also a multiple revelation because God really does encapsulate both Midat HaDin and Midat Rachamim, which, as Marian said, could be understood as Midat HaMet. So now Rabbeinu Bachaye takes us from Revelation straight to the Kruvim. Now, is that all that surprising to us, that he takes us to the Kruvim? No, because the Torah, which is taken down, which is the Luchot, which does have both, is eventually put inside the Aron with the Kruvim on top of it. But he quotes a very interesting pasuk to tell us that the Kruvim actually represent Midat Hadin. What's the verse that he's going to prove to us? He didn't work as hard as I did by showing you every ish el achiv, but what does he do? He finds a different verse. He says, "V'hu yoshev kum ki'inan shakatuv," as it says in Sefer Shmuel, "Lahalot misham et Aron ha'elokim, asher nekra sham shem Hashem tzvakot yoshev hakruvim alav." So here he has a verse in Shmuel where Elokim's is the Aron Elokim and the Kruvim on top of it. "V'hu shemel Shlomo alav Shalom banalo beit hamikdash v'kein yaskir b'kol pam b'pam l'shemecha." Okay, we will skip. We'll skip the rest of this. So, what do we have so far? Let's just regroup a little bit. We have Shabbat, which we forgot about a long time ago. We went from Shabbat to notice the Kruvim. We noticed that the Kruvim represent Midat Hadin. We went from the Kruvim to the Man. We went from the Man to realize that all of Torah represents Midat Hadin, even though the Gemara tells us it's Rachamim. We learned through Rabbeinu Bachaye that there is this multiple perceptions going on in terms of revelation. Along the way, he told us that this also is the idea behind the Shamor v'Zachor b'Dibor Echad. And by the way, let me just point something out to you which you may find interesting. Look at the last page, it's verse 29. Rabbeinu Bachaye, more often than not, which by the way, he's a fascinating, long-winded commentary. So what I would suggest is that go through Rashi at least one time, then go through the Ramban, and after you go through the Ramban, then go through Rabbeinu Bachaye. Because Rabbeinu Bachaye, more often than not, is quoting the Ramban, either by name or by citing whole chunks of it. He clearly had the Ramban open in front of him. And very often the Ramban says things which are a little bit difficult to understand, and Rabbeinu Bachaye explains it. So we just now read the Rabbeinu Bachaye, but we didn't read the Ramban. Let's just look at something in the Ramban on the same area, namely, instead not on Deber Elokim, but rather by the Zachor v'Shamor, which he mentioned in passing. Here the Ramban mentions the clear, the well-known, and the obvious problem. What does it say in Sefer Shemot? Zachor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. Remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. What does it say in the book of Deuteronomy, in Sefer Devarim, Parashat Ve'et Chanan, there it says, Shamor Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. So, source 29. Ba'amar, Zachot Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho, V'mishna Torah, Ketuv Shamor Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho, V'rav Betenu Omru B'zeh, Zachor V'Shamor B'Dibur Echad Nemru. And what do the rabbis say about this? They say that God said both of them together, both of them at one time. Skip to the next paragraph. Va'ani Tama. He goes, I'm really little shocked. Im ne'mar zachor v'shamor mipi ha'gvura. By the way, here you notice mipi ha'gvura in terms of the word gvura. Lama lo nichtav v'luchot harishonot. He goes, if God said zachor v'shamor b'dibur echad, so why didn't we write zachor v'shamor on the luchot? If that's what God said, is that a good question? Right. Instead of this and over here and this over there. So look at his answer. V'yitachein shahaya b'luchot harishonot u'v'shniyah ketuv zachor. He says, it's possible, and that's what he thinks. U'moshe piresh li'Yisrael ki shamor ne'emar imo v'zeh kavanatam be'emet. What does he say? See, there's a couple different things. There's what God said, there's what God said to write, and there's what Moshe said. This is what's written Ve'et Chanan. That's what's written in Yitro. But that doesn't necessarily reflect what was written on the first Luchot, what's written on the second Luchot. What does God say? Zachor v'Shamor. By the way, do all the people understand everything which is said? We've already learned that they haven't. What does it say on the first Luchot which God gave Moshe? Zachor v'Shamor. That's what it says. What happened to those Luchot? They got broken. What does it say then on the second Luchot? Zachor. Moshe can't write what God says, because God said these two things simultaneously, which itself is supernatural, and the whole first luchot are more supernatural than the second luchot. The first luchot are written by the hand of God, the second luchot are written by Moshe. The first luchot, therefore, have Zachor v'Shamor written somehow simultaneously, if you want, on two sides of luchot. If you put them on one side, it says one or the other, or however God managed to write two things at once. But the second luchot, Moshe wrote Zachor, and that's what it says in Yitro. But when Moshe explained it, the Torah Sheba'al Peh, that's what is written in Devarim, but Devarim doesn't represent the second luchot. So according to the Ramban, the first luchot said Zachor v'Shamor. So as I said, that itself is very interesting when it goes back to this issue of perception. Okay. Time for triage, right? Source number 20 is a source that you're familiar with. This is the source about Na'aseh v'Nishma. Source 20. B'sha she'ekdimu Yisrael na'aseh l'nishma ba'u shishim ribo shel malachei asheret v'kol achad v'chad Yisrael kashru lo shnei tarim. When the Jews said na'aseh before nishma, God sent angels, and angels put two crowns on each of their heads. Echad k'neged na'aseh v'echad k'neged nishma. V'kevin shechatu Yisrael, but when they sinned, yirdu me'a ve'esrim bibo malchei chavala u'pirkum. 120,000 came and took them away. By the way, the whole Gemara is very strange, right? When they said na'aseh v'nishma, 60,000. 600,000 came, sorry. Shishim ribo. 600,000 angels came and put two crowns. But afterwards, when they sinned, 120 came, and apparently each one took one of the crowns, because each of two. So one angel put two crowns, but two angels had to come, each one removing one crown. Okay, so you can try to figure this out, but obviously there's something which is deep going on over here. Let's quickly look at the Marsha in Source 21. Umishum shekdimu na'aseh l'nishma dahainu shekublu aleim shnei chalkei Torah. Ha'achad asiyam shebetorah dahainu na'aseh v'asheni halavin shebetorah hainu nishma. So what were the two things they accepted? Na'aseh v'nishma is the mitzvot aseh, is the na'aseh, the mitzvot aseh. What's the v'nishma? Nishma is that we won't do the lo ta'aseh. Na'aseh is we'll do the positive commandment, and the nishma is we'll listen, and therefore we won't do the negative commandments. That's the na'aseh v'nishma. That's the two crowns. The Na'aseh is we'll do the positive, and nishma we'll listen to you, and we won't do the negative. Source 22 is a medrash which is similar. I'm going to skip through the first part of it, which is a very nice mashal, which is your homework. You can, if you choose to accept that. It says that at the end of 22, Kach Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu. Therefore, and now it's explaining the mashal. It says, Kach Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, Shnei Kosot Mazagtem B'Sinai. At Sinai, there were two cups that were poured, which means, you know, to pour into a cup. Na'aseh v'nishba. Shavartem na'aseh. You broke the na'aseh. How did they break the na'aseh? Asitem l'fana egel. You made an egel. So therefore you messed up the na'aseh. His haruba nishma. Be very careful not to do the nishma. Which is interesting, because the way the Midrash tells it to us is that there's na'aseh v'nishma. We messed up one of them, we should still have the other one. But what was the whole thing that the angel, that the Gemara said? Shehikdimu na'aseh v'nishma. Shehikdimu means that they somehow na'aseh v'nishma are merged together, and they said the na'aseh before the nishma. When they mess up, they apparently lose both crowns, because what they had done is they'd interwoven them together. If that's not clear enough, it's fine. I just want to go back to the beginning. All the way, and this shouldn't come as a great surprise, in source number 15, we find Vayishlachehu Hashem Elokim Migan Eden La'avodat Adama Shelokach Misham. Man is expelled from the Garden of Eden. Vayigaresh et Adam Vayishken Mikedem Legan Eden et Kruvim. And God puts the Kruvim. Here is the first use of Kruvim. Ve'lahat hacherev hamitapechet v'shmor derech yitzchayim. And what's the role of the Kruvim? To guard the path with the fiery sword, the path to the Eitz HaChayim. What's the Eitz HaChayim we know? Eitz HaChayim Mechzikim Ba. The Torah is a tree of life. So over here, the purpose of the Kruvim is to guard the tree of life. Okay. So let me make an observation that I have not seen anybody make, although I can't guarantee you that no one ever said this. Look at Source 16. Vayikach Hashem Elokim et Adam. God took Adam, vayinichehu began Eden, and he placed him in Gan Eden. The word vayinichehu is interesting, but hold on for that a second. What was his role in Gan Eden? La'ovda u'lashomra. So here we have two things, la'ovda u'lashomra, which is again very similar to the na'aseh v'nishma. Correct. The Midrash in Source 18, vayinichehu. What does it mean that God put him in Gan Eden? Which you already heard the Na'aseh v'Nishma here. What does it mean? Natan lo mitzvot Shabbat. God gave him the mitzvah of Shabbat. Kimada at Amar, as it says, Vayanach b'yom ha'shvi'i. So it's focusing on the word Vayinachehu is connected Vayanach, to rest. God placed him in Gan Eden. What does it mean to be in Gan Eden? Gan Eden is again, it's paradise. And if it's paradise, so what are we talking about in terms of working? What does it mean, la'ovda u'lashomra? It's Gan Eden. Everything, you have the rivers flowing, you have the trees growing. What does it mean, even, la'ovda u'lashomra? So the Midrash says, v'nach b'yom ha'shvi'i la'ovda, sheshet yimim ta'avod u'lashomra. Shemort yom ha'shvi'i, sorry, I read that wrong. V'nach mitzvot shiva kumod at amar, as it says later on, v'nach b'yom ha'shvi'i la'ovda, sheshet yimim ta'avod, u'lashomra, shemort yom ha'shabbat l'kadsho. So over here we realize that the Shabbat, in its most pure sense, is connected to la'ovda u'lashomra. If you want to see clearly back in the Rebbeinu Bachai now, on that place in Bereshit, Source 19, Ela lasok b'dvrei Torah u'lashmor kol mitzvah shenemar l'shmor ederech eitz ha'chayim ve'ein eitz ha'chayim ela Torah shenemar eitz chayim hi l'machzikim ba u'lovda l'shomar zu Shabbat l'ovda shenemar sheshet v'im ta'avod u'lashomra t'chtiv shemot yom ha'shabbat, which means that the Zachor v'shamor, which we later on find by Har Sinai, which are being said together, but the people don't necessarily perceive both of them together, because the people's perception is one of din instead of the perception of racham. And Moshe understands what's being said properly, but the people don't. The people end up trying to accept the Torah and saying na'aseh v'nishma, but they end up messing up. And how do they mess up? By making the ego. But this whole scene, which is played out by Har Sinai, is actually a repetition of a scene which was played out long before that, and that's the scene that took place in the Garden of Eden, when their role was la'ovda u'lashomra, which is being understood over here in these sources, and there are numerous more, specifically in relation to Shabbat. But you'll say, what does it mean in Shabbat? It means, zochor yom ha'shabbat kadsho. The Ramban tells us, and that Ramban, that again, you can look at it later, that it means to prepare for Shabbat. You remember Hillel and Shammai, they used to go and buy things for Shabbat, or used to say Hayom Yom Shabbat. All of that's before Shabbat. Zochorat Yom Shabbat Lakadsho is what you do the whole week. That's how you prepare for Shabbat. On the other hand, Shamorat Yom Shabbat Lakadsho, that's actually guarding the Shabbat. Which means keeping Shabbat properly is Zochor v'Shamor, but that's it's a week-long thing, but that brings the two things together. What did the verse say when they were kicked out of Gan Eden? And let's read this now much more carefully. Back in Source 15. Vayishalchehu Hashem Elokim migan Eden la'avod et ha'adama asher lukach misham. Now we find that Adam has to be Oved, Source 15. Oved et ha'adama. What did it say originally? La'ovda u'lashomra. What was the Ovda v'Shamra in its pure sense? Man living in the Garden of Eden, hanging out with God, having all spiritual and physical needs taken care of in the Garden of Eden. But what was man's one job there? To be Mekadesh HaShabbat. God created him 6 days and rested on the seventh. Man needed to understand this, to recognize this, and all during the week to prepare for Shabbat, and then on Shabbat to keep the Shabbat. But what does man do instead? Man instead rebels against God. Man instead ignores God. Man says, I can be like God, I can eat from the tree, ignore God, not listen to God, and so on. So therefore, what was his job? Ovda ulishamra. That gets divided. If you look at Pasuk Kaf Gimel, what does it say? Vayishlechei Hashem Elokim miGan Eden. They were kicked out of Gan Eden. La'avod et adamah. Here's la'ovda. Now the work gets transferred, and so now you got to start working. Now you have to work the ground. But what happened to the shomra? Where's the guarding that took place? V'yigeresh et ha'adam v'yishkein mikedem l'gan Eden et ha'kruvim v'et lahat ha'cherev ha'mitapechet l'shmor derech etz ha'chayim. So now the role of guarding became the domain of the kruvim. Which means we messed up in terms of the guarding, we messed up in terms of what God had told us to do, and we lost that. Man then wanders a long time with the la'ovda or the shomra separated. Shomra is no longer in our hands till we get back to Har Sinai. And then God says, Zachor v'shamor b'dibur echad. And now the two come together. And the Jewish people apparently sense something and they say, Na'aseh v'nishma. But what happens by Gan? What happens then by Har Sinai? We mess up one and the God says, but hold on to the other. Moshe apparently wants to take us back to where we need to be, and that's why he starts to teach us with the Shabbat. Because it's the Shabbat which can merge together the two. And the people in the desert, I mean, what kind of work are they doing? Their work should be to focus on spirituality. Focus on the fact that God created in 6 days. Focus on the fact that God rested on the seventh. But try to merge the two together to get back to the Na'aseh and the Shema, the Shamor v'Zachor. And that could be this whole issue of the Kruvim as well. Because the purpose of the Kruvim, as we saw by Gan Eden, was the Shmor Derech LeEtz HaChaim, was to guard the path. And therefore we get in this week's Parsha again, later on we find that the Kruvim are built, but the purpose of the Kruvim is the Shmor, but it's specifically the Shmor which we seem to have messed up. Again, by the way, what I'm glossing over, because it's not consistent, is which did they mess up, the Naseh or the Nishma? Which means by making a golden calf, did they not listen to God? Meaning their asiyah is messed up because they made a golden calf, so the asiyah is wrong. But ultimately, they weren't listening to a mitzvah. Lo tasei, lo yelachem Elohim achirim. Not to make other gods. So which is it? Is it the asay or is it lo sasei which is involved in avodah zarah? And the truth is, if you look at the two first mitzvot, which one mi pi hagvura, one is anochi, and the other is lo yelacha. One is the positive that I am God, the other is and don't make any other gods. The reality is that they heard that mipi hagvura, but somehow it just didn't resonate properly. If we're surprised that it didn't resonate properly, this is a mistake that people have been making, you know, since the very dawn of history. But I think that that's the reason why Shabbat is introduced specifically at this point, because keeping Shabbat properly is able to take these two elements and merge them together to be able to recreate the Naseh v'Nishma, recreate through the Shamor v'Zachor. Shabbat Shalom.